is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you on VE Day. We'll talk about that a little later on. But it's Friday, and it's the first hour of our program, so it's time for Brunch with Bernie, our weekly chat and national town hall meeting, really, with the senator from Vermont, Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. What's on your plate?
Well, it has been a busy week in many respects. I am the ranking member, which is kind of the leader of the opposition, leader of the Democrats, on the Budget Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And this week we voted on a Republican budget, which won, I believe, 51 to 49. And Tom, this budget is so bad that when I talk about it, people really don't believe me. But it is a budget which so clearly represents the interest of the billionaire class and so clearly represents an attack on working families and the middle class that it is almost beyond comprehension that a major political party could bring it forth. And what I found very disturbing in terms of this whole process, and this is something we've been working on for months, is how little attention this disastrous budget is paid by the media. But let me just briefly go over what this budget does. For a start, just in a rather cavalier manner, it throws 27 million people off of health insurance. How's that?
Whoa.
Nothing
serious. This is the Republican budget.
People off health insurance by ending the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare, and by cutting Medicaid by well over $400 billion. When you end the Affordable Care Act, you're throwing 16 million people off of health insurance, many of whom for the first time have had health insurance, and then you're throwing another 11 off by making massive cuts in Medicaid. When I ask the Republicans what happens to these 27 million people, how many of them die, how many of them become much sicker than they otherwise would, how many of them end up in an emergency room with great cost to the healthcare system? They have no answer. None. That's it. 27 million. We are the only country, only major country, that does not guarantee healthcare to all people as a right. And they throw 27 million people off of healthcare on top of the 35 million we already have who are uninsured. That's it. Now, what do you think?
It's astonishing. This is the Republican budget. Why is it the media doesn't
talk
about it?
I'll tell
you
why. It's a very interesting – there are two reasons why. The budget is not an appropriations bill. The budget is a framework. And the framework will then go to the budget – will go to the Appropriations Committee where real legislation will be developed. And if legislation is very bad, I think it's fair to say that Barack Obama will, in fact, veto – legislation which repeals Obamacare. Fair guess, right?
Sure.
All right. So what they're saying, well, you know, this isn't really real. It's not going to be 100% applicable because this is just the framework. And that's true. But on the other hand, this is the framework. This is what the Republican Party, the party that controls the House and the Senate, actually believes. I think we should talk about it. Then, not only that, every listener knows that it is becoming increasingly difficult for young people and families to send kids to college. And many of our young people leave college with deep debts. The Republican solution is to cut $90 billion over a 10-year period in mandatory funding for Pell Grants, Pell Grants being the major source of grants provided by the federal government. Millions of working families will find it harder to send their kids to college as a result. So the solution to the crisis of college affordability, make massive cuts in Pell Grant programs. In terms of nutrition, it is no secret that we have today some 45 million Americans living in poverty, and a number of them are really struggling every single day to figure out how they're going to put food on the table for their kids. Half the kids in our public schools, I believe, are on free or reduced lunch programs. So nutrition is a big issue in this country. And yet what the Republicans did is make massive, massive cuts in food stamp program and the women, infant, and child program. This is a program that provides nutrition for low-income pregnant women and their babies cut. The Meals on Wheels program cut for elderly, fragile seniors. I mean, unbelievably cruel. And then on top of cutting healthcare, education, and nutrition, what the Republicans also do is they decide that one of the great tax problems in our country is that at a time when we have massive levels of income and wealth inequality, what they believe is that the top two-tenths, not 1%, top two-tenths of 1% of the richest families in America deserve over a 10-year period a $269 billion break in their taxes. Got that? That's by repealing the estate tax. The estate tax only applies to the top two-tenths of 1%. They repeal it. $269 billion goes to the wealthiest 5,500 families in America. That's it. Now, to add insult to injury, what they also do, after giving huge tax breaks to billionaire families, they then come back and say, we are going to allow to expire the increased benefits we put into the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit for low-income and working families. Those increased benefits will expire, meaning lower-income and working families will pay more in taxes. So, you know, if you were to sit down and write a budget that reflects the greed of the billionaire class, more tax breaks for billionaires, savage cuts to virtually every program that working families need. This is the budget that you would write. And I think, you know, if the American people knew what was in this budget, knew what the Republicans stood for, I honestly believe they would have a hard time getting 15-20% of the vote. But that was the reality. So that's one issue that we have been working on really hard. And what I will be doing, along with a number of other progressive senators, is to make sure that these ideas are not translated into legislation. And to the degree that they are, we've got to make sure that the president vetoes that legislation. A lot of other issues going on. The president, I believe, today is going to be in Oregon with Nike officials. And he's going to use that stage as an opportunity to push for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I believe that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a disastrous trade agreement based on a number of other disastrous trade agreements. Tom, when we try to understand why it is that despite a huge increase in technology and productivity, the middle class of this country has been disappearing for 40 years. If we try to understand why it is that people are working two or three jobs, working 50, 60 hours a week, why median family income today is almost $5,000 less than it was in 1999, there are a lot of reasons out there. And income and wealth inequality, the fact that there's been a huge transfer of wealth, I'm talking about many trillions of dollars from the middle class to the top one-tenth of 1%, is one of the reasons. And part of that reason has to do with our disastrous trade policies.
Yep.
Okay, you know, you and I have talked about this for years, and that is NAFTA, CAFTA, the Permanent Normal Trade Relations with China. And now what this trade agreement, TPP, is building on is essentially the ideology of past disastrous trade agreements. So right now, as part of this TPP, if it were to be passed, and I'll do everything I can to see that it is not passed, you're going to have American workers being forced to compete against workers in Vietnam with minimum wages, I believe, 56 cents an hour. They're going to be competing against workers in Malaysia, where they literally have forced labor. And that's something we must not allow to happen.
Agreed. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders. Your opportunity to speak with him. We'll be right back with your calls for Bernie. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Be sure to check out Senator Sanders' website. It's sanders.senate.gov. He's also got a fairly prominent presence over on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome back, Senator. Pick up some calls now.
Let's do it.
Okay, Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Okay, hi. Senator Sanders, great to speak with you. I wanted to ask you a question and get your take. And the question's regarding messaging, packaging, and framing the debate. I saw you on George Stephanopoulos' show, And of course, the corporate media immediately is trying to tag you with the awful words socialist, because Americans, they understand the ignorance of the American public. They don't understand that word. And I'd like to get your take on what you can do to change this into being an American message.
Good.
And what I want to say to you is, when they ask you, Bernie, are you a socialist? What you can do is say, well, you know, they called FDR a socialist, and his New Deal progressive policies rescued us from the Republican Great Depression, and he is now ranked next to Lincoln as one of our greatest American presidents. And then you could say, I'm an FDR liberal, and if that means I'm a socialist and I stand proudly next to one of our great American leaders, FDR. Next question, Mr. Stephanopoulos.
Well, Tom, let me take it a bit further. And I didn't think that Stephanopoulos was attempting to be unfair. Because if people say, are you a democratic socialist? I say, yes, I do. And then the question is, and I happen to think FDR, as you've indicated, Tom, was a very great American president who led this country out of the worst depression that we've ever had, with a whole lot of innovative programs that are still in existence, and many of which our Republican friends want to repeal today. But also, we have to ask ourselves, what does it mean to be a democratic socialist? What is that about? And what I do is look at countries around the world, often countries like Denmark, Norway, Finland, Scandinavia, Germany occasionally. And what I say is, look, the United States and our country, we do a lot of very good things. But you got to be really dumb not to look around the world to take advantage of what other countries do better than we do. Other countries should look to us to see what we do well. And when I look at social democratic countries, countries which have had labor governments, social democratic governments, democratic socialist governments, this is what I see. I see in every major country on earth, not just Scandinavia, healthcare is a right of all people. It's no longer a debate. The conservative parties in Denmark and Sweden, no one argues that healthcare is a right. All people have healthcare. And it turns out that in virtually all other countries, their healthcare system is not just universal. It is much more cost-effective than our system, whose primary function is to enable the private insurance companies and the drug companies to make enormous profits. So, you want to call me a democratic socialist because I believe that healthcare is a right and that it is absurd for the United States of America to be spending almost double what any other country on earth spends per person? Fine, call me a socialist. I accept it. Next issue. What is more fundamental and important for a nation than education? Education is what we do as human beings. Hopefully all of us try to learn and learn until the day that we die. It's part of what being human is about. Well, we'll continue that discussion after the break.
Okay, great. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here with Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls. Stick around. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Senator Sanders, Tom from Minnesota just called and suggested that when asked about being a democratic socialist, instead of invoking Sweden, perhaps you should invoke FDR. You were talking about
that. Well, I think, you know, I happen to think that FDR was one of the great presidents of our country. But I also think that it is absolutely imperative that we look around the world And we see what other countries do better than we did. And I was mentioning that in terms of healthcare, you know, we have essentially a dysfunctional system. We're the only major country on earth without a national healthcare system. But it's not just healthcare as a right. You took a look at education. In a highly competitive global economy, the idea that the United States is slipping further and further behind other countries in terms of the percentage of our people who have college degrees is absurd, is wrong. So if you look at countries like Germany and, again, Scandinavia, Austria, other countries, Tom, do you know how much they charge for tuition in their public colleges and universities?
I know in Denmark they actually pay you to go to college. We had a caller from Denmark last week, and he said he got $900 a month.
Right. I mean, so the point is this good public policy? Well, you know what? In America today, you have large numbers of lower income and working class families where their young people are bright, they're eager, they want to go to college, but they are saying, I'm not going to go to college and come out $50,000, $80,000 in debt. Not going to do it. So we lose all of the intellectual potential of those young people in a highly competitive global economy where we need the best educated workforce. Does that make any sense? I don't think so. So yes, if democratic socialism means that every person in this country should be able to get a higher education regardless of the income of their family, yeah, I'm a democratic socialist. I think it makes a lot more sense to be investing in our young people, or all working people, by the way, so they can get the education they need rather than giving tax breaks to billionaires. People want to criticize me for that? Go for it. That's fine. I accept it. That's what I believe. I believe that it is totally crazy when every psychologist in this world understands that the most formative years of a human being's life are 0 to 4. And yet today in this country, where we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country, working class parents all over America finding it almost impossible to acquire good quality, affordable child care. So again, call me a democratic socialist. I believe that all of our young people deserve high quality child care, that we need to pay child care workers a living wage, that they need to have the education and the training that should be requisite in order to take care of the young kids, the very youngest kids in this country. If that's crime, fine. It's a crime. That's what I believe. Call that democratic socialism.
Okay. Let's pick up some calls here. Nina in Tuscola, Illinois. I'm sorry. Nina, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator. My question is, would you consider publishing your positions in a pamphlet and calling it Common Sense?
It's a great idea.
Common Sense after Tom Paine?
Yeah.
I like it, Nina. I like that. The answer is yes. We are, you know, our campaign has just begun, and we've been a little bit overwhelmed for the last week. I think we have 200,000 people who have indicated that they want to be part of the campaign, and you know, 80,000 people have contributed on BernieSanders.com, and our phones are bouncing off the hook. So we haven't really published anything, but I like that idea. I like that idea a lot, and maybe that should be the title of it. You know, the views that I have are not complicated. They're pretty sensible. I think they're commonsensical, so common sense is not a bad idea for it, and I think they have the support of a whole lot of people. Nina, I like that idea very much. Thanks.
Erica in Long Beach, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Yeah, I'm from Long Beach, California. I'm a younger generation. I'm a young voter. I'm in my early 20s. And I think it's interesting how you seem to have garnered a lot of support from my generation, especially on websites such as like Reddit and stuff, where like Reddit/r/Sanders for President, like so many subscribers were trying to get interest for you. And I think it's very special that you seem to have like this, just something about you that we want, like as a young generation, like the passionate people that we want. And since it's so rare, I think in this generation now to have such young people voting, how are you going to try to get more interest? Like, are you trying to outreach to like the internet more? I mean, I heard about this through Twitter, and I'm watching you on YouTube right now. Like, are you pushing for a lot more internet coverage, I think?
Absolutely, Erica. We are investing very heavily in the campaign. We are working with a group called Revolution, who were the folks who initiated a lot of President Obama's efforts in 2008. They're kind of cutting edge. So we're going to be all over social media. And once we get geared up, and it'll take us a few more weeks to do that, we're going to be producing stuff every single day, not only just about me and the campaign, but some of the important things that are going on in America. So social media and reaching out to young people is very important. On Monday night, I'm going to be, I believe, in the University of Virginia campus talking about the high cost of college education. But it's not just college young people. We have a 17% unemployment rate today for young people in general, and that is obviously much too high, and we've got to figure out how we tap the intellect and the energy of young people to help transform America. So short answer is, Erica, yes, absolutely. We are going to be reaching out and trying to involve as many young people as we can in the campaign.
Jason in Cosa Mesa, California. We just have a minute to the break. Real quick question, Jason, please.
I just want to make a point about I'm a progressive and a liberal, but I'm not a Democrat. And I think it's really important that if you have a chance in the primary that you urge people like me to re-register as Democrats so we can have an opportunity to take back the Democratic Party.
Okay. Thanks very much, Jason. Good point.
Thoughts on that, Senator?
I am running. You know, one of the issues that I had to deal with is, do I run as within the Democratic primary process, or have gone outside of it? And I've decided to run in it. And if we're going to do well, people are going to have to be able to vote in those primaries, participate in the caucuses, and they're going to have to do that within the structure of the Democratic Party. So Jason is absolutely right.
Yeah. So particularly in those closed primary states, yeah, it becomes quite critical. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders after this. Be sure to check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 202-536-2370.
We'll be right back with more of Bernie. Sanders.senate.gov. Check it out. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Senator Sanders back on the line with us. Senator?
I am right here. How
okay, great. Let's see. Next call, Paul in Woodinville, Washington. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom.
Hello, Paul.
Bernie, I'm 55 years old. I taught high school math and science until I lost my eyesight to a disease which I was born with, and I am now about 95% blind, but I live on Social Security disability, which the United States House of Representatives has made taken the unconscionable action of holding hostage as of the first day of this legislative session. My question is, what are you going to tell the American people about Social Security and Social Security disability? But before you answer, I want to say this, that even though I live on less than $1,100 a month, I found $25 this week to join Team Bernie Sanders and contribute to the campaign. And I'm asking everybody that's listening right now to go to BernieSanders.com and either match my $25 contribution. Can you tell us what you're going to say about Social Security briefly?
Well, Paul, let me just start off by telling you, when I hear you say what you just said, it moves me very much. It really does. And thank you very much. You know, first thought, in terms of what the Republicans are doing, what the Republicans are trying to do is create a phony crisis in the disability insurance program, which is part of Social Security. And what they are saying is, well, Social Security, the disability program, in a few years is going to go broke, and there will be, I believe, a 19%, we'll have to reduce benefits by something like 19%. And the only way that the Republicans can think of to not reduce benefits for the disabled by 19% is making cuts in other aspects of Social Security, i.e. the retirement program, all of which is total and absolute nonsense. What you have is two separate programs which operate under the same roof. And what has happened time after time after time is when one of the programs, in this case the disability program, is running short on money, we transfer money from the retirement program. Sometimes when the retirement program was running low on money, we transferred money from the disability program. That's all that has to happen. That's what the president wants, and that is what I want. And that's what we're going to make to happen. The idea of either cutting disability benefits for somebody like Paul, who's just hanging on now financially, is totally unconscionable, is beyond belief. And the idea of making cuts for the retirement program when we have millions of other seniors in exactly the same position as Paul who are older is also unconscionable. So we have introduced legislation that would expand Social Security benefits by lifting the cap on taxable income, which is now at $118,000. So, Paul, this is an issue we are going to work very, very, very hard on. I will do everything. To make sure there are not going to be cuts in the disability program or in Social Security in general. In fact, At a time when so many of the disabled and seniors are struggling, we need to expand benefits, not cut them. But thanks so much for your thoughts and your support.
Patrick, in Jacksonville, North Carolina, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Sanders, Senator. Just want to first say your campaign announcement literally brought me to tears, so I appreciate you getting involved and getting in the ring. Number two, and I think this is a number of people have brought this up in the social media circles that I've been tracking. There's not many places where anyone can really attack your record as a liberal progressive. The one place that I've seen people consistently come at you has been on gun control. I don't disagree with your history, so I don't want it to feel like I'm trying to bind you up. How would you choose for those of us trying to support your campaign to couch your record with regard to preventing litigation against firearms manufacturers and dealers?
Well, what we're going to do, you know, what's going on now is our opponents are trying to dig into my record, and that's fair enough, and cast look at every vote that I cast. And again, Patrick, let me tell you, we just announced last week, and as I said on this program many times previously, I honestly wasn't sure if I was going to run or not. We made the decision. We've got a lot of homework to do to go over every vote that we cast. But let me just say, in general, on guns, I come from a very rural state. In the state of Vermont, we have almost no gun control at all, and that's kind of what the majority of the people of our state feel comfortable with. In Vermont and other very rural states, what guns are about are hunting, guns are about target shooting, a lot of antique gun collectors. And in fact, we have a pretty low, thank God, crime rate here in the state of Vermont. But obviously the rest of the country, whether it's Baltimore, Los Angeles, New York City, whatever, guns, you know, are associated with drug dealers and killers and everything else. So looking at it in a national perspective is different than looking at it in a Vermont perspective. I should tell you, Patrick, that to the best of my knowledge, and I'm quite sure I'm right on this, what my critics on about guns don't tell you is that I have an F NRA voting record. So the idea that I am some kind of gun nut and blah, 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 blah is just not true. Again, I have an F rating from the NRA because I have voted for a number of things that they don't like. But we are going to examine our gun record, and this is an important issue. Everybody in this country is shocked beyond belief in terms of what happened at Sandy Hook in Connecticut and what's happened, the disasters that we've seen. And I think there is widespread belief that we need sensible gun control, sensible gun control. And we will kind of work out what exactly that means. But you raise a very fair question. But don't let anyone tell you that I'm some kind of a gun nut when I got an F voting record from the NRA. But you're right. My record deserves discussion, and we'll have a position about where we go from here in terms of our views on this important issue.
Maxine in Louisville, Colorado. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Louisville here in Colorado.
Oh.
You pronounce the S.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Sanders, I am so thrilled that you're running, and my nine-year-old daughter is also thrilled, and she's ready to go campaign for you. And I think Colorado is a great place for you because
yep.
there's such a large percentage of independents here. I think there's a great opportunity. My question really is about Obamacare, and I'm wondering if and when you get elected president, if you would consider really updating Obamacare. One of the real issues is for those of us who are self-employed, because we have to figure out how much money we're going to make more than a year in advance of when we make that money, and then figure out what kind of subsidy we're eligible for. It would make a lot more sense for self-employed people to base it on last year's taxes instead of next year's, when we have no idea what next year's taxes are going to be like.
Right. Very good point, Maxine. I mean, it's very hard for somebody who's self-employed or from, you know, many people in the business world to be able to predict what they're going to make next year. So I think that's an absolutely valid point. I think in terms of Obamacare, I voted for it for a number of reasons. But let me be very clear. I think we've got to go a lot further in terms of healthcare. I happen to believe in a Medicare for all single-payer system, not only because it will be universal and not only because it will be more cost-effective, it will be less complicated. Obamacare is a very, very complicated healthcare system. I believe in simple. But and Maxine, you point out one of the problems of it. Thank you.
Alex in Minooka, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Let me first say that I am glad to know that you're running. I've been a huge fan of yours since high school. I'm a college student right now, and I'm wondering, like, obviously the education system has some flaws, especially student debt. And my question is, like, what would you do to help students who have, you know, student debt and things like that? Because I, you know, even me who goes to community college and I work, I still can't even afford to go to school part-time.
Alex, thanks so much for your question. And, you know, Tom, one of the things that I love about your show and what you do very, very well is I think there are a whole lot of, you know, just middle-class, working-class people who listen and are prepared to volunteer and talk about the realities of their life.
Yeah.
And that's what makes the show so good. It's not some kind of abstract, you know, discussion about great ideas. It's talking about the real lives of real people. All right, so Alex tells us he goes to the community college. He's worried about student debt. What are we going to do about it? Student debt in this country is now, if my memory is correct, about $1.2 trillion. Does that sound right, Tom?
That is right, yes.
Yeah. And growing every day. The legislation that we are going to be offering, which will focus on making tuition free for public colleges and universities, also will deal with student debt. And we deal with it, again, we're still working on all of the details in two basic ways. What Obama did was correct, which is to take away a lot of student lending from the banks where they were making a fortune and give it over to the federal government. Profits are now coming into the federal government. I'd rather see that than going into the banks. But, frankly, I do not believe that the federal government should be making profits off of people like Alex and millions of others. If people are borrowing money to go to college, by definition, they don't have a lot of money. And I don't think the federal government should be profiting off of them. So if you take away the profit margin, you can lower student interest rates in a significant way. And the other way is to right now make sure that interest rates are a lot lower, closer to what the Fed interest rates are, and lower to what auto interest rates are and mortgage rates rather than where they are right now. A number of ways we can lower student interest rates.
We'll be right back with more Senator Sanders.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And check out Sanders.Senate.gov for Bernie's web. It's, you know, Bernie's website, a great news source. You can sign up for his newsletter, the Bernie Buzz there, all kinds of cool stuff. Welcome back. Steve in Phoenix, Arizona. You're watching Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Happy birthday, Tom. And also, thank you, Senator Sanders, for fighting these dastardly Social Security disability cuts. It's unconscionable. And my question is this. Anyone who's receiving Social Security in any form, if their income is over $44,000, and this includes pension, stocks, interest, whatever it may be, and you're filing jointly, and that could include a still working spouse, their Social Security benefits are taxed at 85%. And this apparently was put in by Reagan in 1983. And can this be abolished, or at least the threshold be raised to $100,000 or more? And this would help solidify the middle class.
Steve,
Republicans are always seeming to be about tax cuts, and this is something that would help the middle class. But I don't know if they'd support it. I'm sure they wouldn't. But anyways, thank you, Senator. I appreciate you running for president. I'm doing a donation to you, and I'll take your question or your answer off the air. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Steve. Good point. And I think, you know, it is time that we took a hard look at all aspects of Social Security, including the taxes paid by Social Security beneficiaries and how much they're paying. So the answer to your question is yes. What I have been simply focusing right now on as the founder of the Defending Social Security Caucus is, A, do everything that we can to prevent any cuts from Social Security. And that's been a struggle we've gone on for years. I think we're winning that right now. We're going to have to deal with our Republican colleagues now and see what they want to do. But I think we're going to win that one. But point number two is, how do we expand Social Security benefits? Point number three is, how do we extend the life of Social Security? And I think that has everything to do with lifting the cap, which is now at $118,000. But the bottom line of all of this is, if you look at the folks who are on Social Security, we have many of them who are trying to get by on $13,000, $14,000 a year. We had a call from somebody on disability, same problem. And we've got to expand benefits for those folks. An interesting point to, just to make in passing is that when we talk about income and wealth inequality, one of the impacts of the growing disparity between the very, very rich and everybody else is that it's had a huge impact on the solvency of Social Security. And in fact, we've lost about 19 or 20 years of solvency because of stagnant incomes and the fact that more and more people are above the $118,000 threshold. So answer, yes, let's take a look at all aspects of Social Security, how we make it fairer.
We have about 45 seconds, Senator. Thoughts on raising the cap?
Absolutely. No, we have legislation that does that. But in terms of Social Security, though, what you're looking at is a political issue in the sense that if millions of people, and they are, I submitted a petition, came from the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. The petition was given to Senator Sheldon Whitehouse and myself. It had 2 million names on it. And when our Republican friends see the reality that millions of people are saying, you are not going to cut Social Security, you're going to raise benefits, we know what's going on. When they see that, they're going to back off. That's why people have got to be mobilized and pay attention to what's going on.
We'll be back with more of your calls, your questions for Senator Sanders right after this. It's our Brunch and Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Sanders on the line with us. Lucas in Portland, Oregon. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Senator Sanders. It's an honor to talk to both you and Tom. I had a more of a point and a question. If you'd be willing to support a program that would put solar panels on our schools, and if you would spearhead something like that, because if you think about it, in the summertime, 3 months out of the year that the kids aren't at school, it's just basically creating a lot of power for the community and all this other thing.
Lucas, not only would I support that concept, I did support that concept. It is law and has resulted in solar panels going on to the roofs of schools all over Vermont and I suspect other parts of the country. Along with Bob Menendez, we passed legislation a few years ago called the Energy Efficiency Block Grant Program, which put about $3 billion in energy efficiency and sustainable energy. And I can tell you, in Vermont, a number of schools now have solar panels. It's great for the educators to work with the kids explaining solar energy, explaining energy efficiency, and obviously saves the schools money. I think it's a great idea. On top of that, we have introduced legislation for 10 million solar rooftops, not just for schools, but for homeowners as well. Good question. Thanks, Lucas.
Ray in McHenry, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, I just want to make a simple and quick suggestion I think will help in the debate about money and speech. I've talked to Tom about this before. I know what the Supreme Court has said, but I urge you to start publicly using the term purchased speech to make the distinction between true free speech and such things as political ads and commercials, even owning a media outlet. That type of speech is anything but free. And the vast majority of Americans will never be able to purchase the speech that millionaires and billionaires do. And using that term, as I think, is a way to highlight that inequity. And I think that could also create the meme that such ads are commerce and therefore subject to regulation. That's all I want to say. Thanks.
Great point. Ray, that is, I think, an excellent point. You know, Ray is talking about Citizens United Supreme Court decision. And it's not what Ray is saying, which I agree with. It's not a question of freedom of speech. Right? You want to go out on the street corner and talk? Everybody can do that. These guys are purchasing speech, spending hundreds of millions of dollars to do that. Most people don't have hundreds of millions of dollars to buy TV ads. Excellent point, Ray.
Kathy in Chicago, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Hi. Thanks so much, Senator Sanders, for running. We really appreciate it. And it's an honor to talk to you. My kids are finally going to be impressed with something that I've done.
That's every parent's dilemma, Kathy. Don't worry about it.
I have a question about Iran. But first, I want to kind of piggyback off what I think it was Tom in Minnesota said about the messaging. Those of us that are informed understand your issues and the label. But I have a lot of experience talking to people that are uninformed, and they've been so conditioned socialism is bad that I don't even think they will listen to what you're saying. So I'm just wondering if you could use the term populism, because definitely everything that you promote is very popular. Also, we need T-shirts, because if we could wear them this summer, it could stimulate conversation also. And I also think it would be kind of fun if you subtly referred to FDR by calling the billionaire class economic royalists instead of the billionaire class. And then I have a question about Iran. With the passage of that Iranian bill yesterday, yeah. I know you voted for it, as did everyone except Tom Cotton. And I find it a little disturbing. I'm hoping you can reassure me, but I don't see how anything good can come out of this about our Congress, our dysfunctional Congress, looking at this agreement after it's finalized. And I think that it has an absolutely astounding visual for the world, that the rest of the world should wait while our, again, dysfunctional Congress discusses it.
Good point, Kathy.
Thank you, Kathy.
But I voted for it, and I think that was the right vote. Here's what we were up against. As a result of Senator Cotton and other Republican efforts, it was clear to me, and I think many others, that what a number of Republicans wanted to do is literally sabotage the president's, I think, good efforts in trying to see that Iran does not get a nuclear weapon and do it in a way that doesn't take us into another war, which would be a horrendous, horrendous situation. What this legislation does do is it says that after an agreement is reached, the Congress can vote to disapprove of it. And if it did, between you and me, there would be, if the agreement was a good agreement, and I hope it will be, even if that majority voted to disapprove, the president could veto that. So this is, and we would be able to sustain that veto. So in terms of the real impact, I think the president now has the green light to go ahead. If it's a decent agreement, I don't think it will be disapproved and overturned. And that puts us in a heck of a lot of better position than where we were a few months ago.
Senator, we have a minute and a half left in the hour. Do you want to riff, or would you want to take a quick call?
Let's take one more.
Okay. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Very quick question, please.
Hi, Tom. Sure. Senator Sanders, thank you for taking my call and all you do. My comment is, you know, many families are trapped in perpetual debt cycles due to the outrageous banking fees levied against consumer accounts, you know, especially overdrawn fees. And do you support laws to lower the maximum fees that can be levied against consumer accounts?
Do I support laws that would do that? Oh, my God, Marty. We have introduced legislation years ago to end what is nothing less than usury. That's what you're talking about. So you're having Wall Street banks who are able to acquire money at virtually today very, very low interest rates, charging millions of people, subprime borrowers, interest rates of over 20%. And this is the rich getting much richer and poor people getting much poorer. It is nothing less than usury. This is an issue we have been involved in for a very long time. In fact, I just introduced this week legislation to break up, along with Congressman Brad Sherman of California, legislation to break up the major banks. And one of the points that I made in my statement is that when you have six financial institutions with assets equivalent to 60% of the GDP of America and are charging people these outrageous interest rates, that is the reason, one of the reasons, break them up. So I truly, truly do agree with you on that.
Senator Sanders, thanks so much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you very much.
Great, great talking. We'll be back. Anything Goes Friday right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Interesting goings on in Wisconsin. It's Anything Goes Friday, by the way. I'm going to rant a little bit here for just a minute or three or four or five or six, and then we'll turn it over to a wide open conversation about pretty much any topic you want to talk about. Friday's the day that you don't have to be on topic. Wisconsin Republicans, this Scott Walker stan, or maybe we should call it David and Charles Kokistan. I don't know. But in Scott Walker stan, Wisconsin, they not only want to cut benefits for working people who are making so little money that they cannot support their families. I mean, we're really, really, truly talking about Dickensian stuff here. They not only want to do that, but now these Republicans who claim to hate big government want the government of Wisconsin to examine everything that poor people buy with food stamps. They want to force stores and other businesses to do this. It'll cost a lot of money to upgrade and change computer systems and tracking systems so that when somebody comes through with a food stamp card, the cash register will reject this purchase or that purchase. And it's getting, I mean, truly bizarre. Truly bizarre. I mean, like dry beans, spaghetti sauce, cooking spices. No, I'm sorry, you can't have that, according to Republican Representative Robert Brooks in the Wisconsin legislature. So anyhow, the question was, this is where it gets really crazy. The question was, how much will it cost the state of Wisconsin to snoop into so intrusively and so intensively into the lives of all of our poor people who might be on any kind of public assistance? Turns out it's going to cost millions of dollars. I guarantee you, well, I can't guarantee you, but I would submit to you, this is, not unlike the food stamp applicants and drug tests, that Scott Walker will propose or figure out a way to extract that money from the poor people themselves or take it out of those funds, and will figure out a way that one of his buddies or campaign contributors can make a fortune off this. Just like, Rick Scott down in Florida, he used to own a company that does drug testing. So what does he do? Comes into the governorship. Hey, let's drug test everybody. Well, not everybody, but you get the point. More and more and more and more, because it's so profitable. It's a 20 cents worth of reagents, and we can charge $50 for the test. Meanwhile, this over at the Center for American Progress's Think Progress blog, that both of these, actually, the last one is by Alan Pike, this one by Alice Olstein. They've got to pass a budget. Wisconsin has a law that requires every state in the union except Vermont has either by law or by constitutional mandate, you have to have a balanced budget. And Scott Walker has just really screwed up Wisconsin. When he came into office, Wisconsin had a $1 billion surplus. Now, it's fine to have a surplus. You just can't have a deficit if you want to have a balanced budget. Balanced budgets envision surpluses. He now has a $2 billion deficit because of his tax cuts for rich people and corporations in Wisconsin, which he said would grow the economy like crazy, just like Sam Brownback said in Kansas, and they were both wrong. Paul Krugman's op-ed today, by the way, in the New York Times, fascinating, about how the Brits got this so wrong, and I want to go off on that just a little bit, too. And in fact, if any of you out there, have a really good understanding of the British political system, feel free to call in. It seems to me that a couple of things happened in the UK with this election that are not being discussed in the American press. The first was that the Lib Dems, when Nick Clegg, the Liberal Dems, the most, not the most left-wing party, but one of the more, you know, more left-wing than Labour, when that party joined with the Conservatives to form a coalition government, it would sort of be like, you know, Bernie and I was going to say Obama, but you'd really want a Republican, but a moderate Republican, maybe, you know, Bernie and Dwight Eisenhower getting together. Bernie and Richard Nixon getting together. And only Nixon holds most of the power. And so, you know, they did this austerity thing that the narrative in the UK, as Paul Krugman points out today in his op-ed, the narrative in the UK that the press is pushing and that the Conservatives have been pushing is that back prior to 2010, when the Liberals, the Labour Party, controlled government, that they were spending too much money. And that budget deficit then caused the crash of 2008. And everything is the fault of liberal spending, of the spending by Labour. Well, it turns out that there's literally no truth to that at all. The British economy was doing fine before 2008. The event that took down the British economy was fraud by banksters, mostly in New York, London, and Frankfurt. And, you know, the Conservatives in England, of course, don't want to acknowledge that. They get a lot of money from and a lot of support from the banksters. So two things happened. One, the Lib Dems went along with this austerity program that in 2010 the Conservatives put into place, or 2012 or 13, whatever the year was. It's, you know, right after the last election, they pretty much had to go along with it and cut things like support for schools, so tuitions went up. So a lot, you know, they lost their base. Their base just said, "Screw it, I'm not going to go vote for those guys." They didn't, you know, they sold us out. So the Lib Dems, the Liberal Democrats, the more progressive party, they lost a lot of their base because they didn't hold to their principles. They started behaving like conservatives. I'm telling you, when liberals behave like conservatives, or when when Democrats behave like conservatives, they always lose. Not always, but more often than not. So there's that. But the other thing that the American media is not telling you is that David Cameron, the head of the Conservative Party, right, the Tories, the conservatives, David Cameron supports a national health care system. In fact, he's been outspoken in his support of a national health care system. Now, would any Republican in America say that? No. David Cameron cut defense spending in the UK. Would any Republican in America support that? No. David Cameron proposed raising taxes on rich people in the UK. Would any American support that? No. And here's the big kicker, and this is the one that I think really flipped it, although, as I said, I am no expert on British politics, so if you are, feel free to call in and teach me about this. The problem with the European Union is that it's essentially, you know, the UK is part of the EU, but they don't use the euro. They still have the British pound. Now, you know, stores, businesses in the UK accept euros, but they still have the British currency. But because they joined the EU, that means that workers in Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Poland, you know, countries that are historically much, much poorer than England, which is the richest country in all of Europe right now, that those workers can come to England without having to get a visa. They can just show up and apply for jobs and they're willing to work for half of what Brits will work for. It would be the equivalent of doing away with the Mexican border between the United States and Mexico. And you can imagine how American workers would feel if we just did away with the U.S.-Mexican border. Well, to the best of my knowledge, the Lib Dems have been fine with the affiliation with the EU. But David Cameron, the conservative, said, "I'll put this thing up for a vote." Within the next 12 months, we'll let the people of England decide whether or not we want to let any more cheap labor into this country, or are we going to pull out of the EU? Now, again, I may be wrong on this, but I personally think that that's a really big deal. So we'll be back with Anything Goes Friday right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And to check out TomHartman.com. You can drop into our free live chat room and say hi to some great folks there. Great activity, great conversations. And Sue Nethercutt says, I'm no expert either. You keep me too busy. Sue has done such a great job of providing me with not the things that I was just ranting about, but just, you know, all the statistics and data and whatnot. It's great. So let's see here. Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave, thanks for watching over at TomHartman.com. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, first thing I'd like to say is that your call screener is delightful.
Yeah, that's Danielle. She's super. She's also a great talk show host.
She's fantastic. Hey, I just wanted to bring up, actually, I wanted to bring it up with Bernie. And if you forgive me, I may call in the weeks and try again. But I was wondering if it would be possible to bring into this campaign, into the lexicon here, a very obscure economic term. It's called rent seeking.
Are you talking Henry George here?
And what rent seeking is, for those who don't know, is misallocation of resources to buy advantage or incur a disadvantage to your competitors in the marketplace.
Right.
But translated, it's putting money into politics to affect policy, which is precisely what's going on. It's the root of all evil, if you will. And I was wondering, that'd be a great defense for Bernie. He's undoubtedly going to get attacked about being pro-regulation, where he could turn this and say, no, I'm against regulation. I'm against regulation that is of the rent-seeking kind.
Right.
And you need an example to bring this into the public's mind. There's a perfect one going on right now. In fact, a Wikipedia article on rent-seeking, if folks look it up, gives the example of the taxi licenses, our classic rent-seeking,
yeah,
where you have to purchase this taxi license and it keeps competitors out of the market. Well, right now, this is going on with Uber. And Uber is fighting this rent-seeking and trying to gain a competitive advantage. The public wants it. The market wants it.
Right.
This is anti-free market. There's no way the conservatives can defend it. It's anti-capitalism. Rent-seeking is the antithesis of everything that capitalism is about.
Yeah. Dave, the problem with, and I've tried this, in fact, it's been probably 4 or 5 years, but some years ago, I had been familiar with, it's Henry George, right? His first name?
I believe that was Henry George that coined the term in the 70s.
Yeah, no, he was an economist and a politician around the turn of the century, I thought, of the 19th and 20th century. I could be wrong. And Georgism was a thing, you know, in the 19-aughts and the 1920s.
Actually, I'm sorry, it was Gordon Tullock in 1967. Again, obscure as well.
Yeah,
just as the term.
Okay, but here's the problem: is that as soon as you use the word rent, Americans automatically think that they know what you're talking about. I think we need new language for it, or we need to appropriate old language that is meaningful to people. I think monopoly is probably one of the very best. You know, Thomas Jefferson referred to patent and copyright laws as monopolies, and they are. And rent seeking is a form of monopoly. Maybe if we use that kind of language. Thoughts?
It's probably the most poorly named term, and admittedly, a lot of articles say so. But it actually derives from Adam Smith,
right,
where income was divided into profits, wages, and rent.
Right.
And then
you had the rentiers, the whole rentier class that Henry George used to talk about. Yeah, good point, Dave. It's, you know, the question is, how do you educate Americans about things like this? Particularly when the media doesn't want to talk about any of it. You know, they want to talk about whether the football was inflated. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. And Gabe Meyer in Washington State. Hey, Gabe, what's up? Gabe?
Yes.
Hey, you're on
Gabe
the air.
Meyer calling. Thank you. I'm calling to give you an update on the WAMEND campaign.
Oh, great. This is the Washington State move to amend the Constitution to say money isn't speech and corporations aren't people, right?
Exactly.
Initiative at 735.
We are building on the great foundation last year. I wanted to thank you and all your listeners for supporting our initiative. We are full speed ahead this year. We've already gathered 10,000 signatures, and we have till the end of the year to get this initiative on the ballot. That does exactly what we talk about. It turns, it gets Congress to over to pass a resolution to for a Constitution amendment to say corporations aren't people, money isn't speech, and all political contributions should be made public.
Right. There you go. So, Gabe, what's the website? How do people find out more about it?
It's WAMEND.org, WAMEND.org. We have, thousands and thousands of people signing up and out every day collecting the signatures and getting this on the ballot.
Great. Okay, Gabe, good luck. Good luck. And you're going to check in with us every week, and we'll see how it goes. Thank you for the call.
Sounds great.
I appreciate it. Arne in Vail, Colorado. Hey, Arne, what's up? Whoops. Hang on just a second.
Okay.
Arne, yeah, I hear you now.
Okay. Back in September, I'm a former county commissioner in Colorado, and I started going to Washington, D.C. to lobby and protest against the new war that Obama was taking us into. And in the last several months, I've become an independent journalist and expert on the authorization for military force and what the military has been doing in the Middle East. And without getting into all of the different moving parts, what I've come to notice in just the last few weeks in the coverage on authorization for military force or the lack of, is that Congress isn't really going to carry forward and try to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And we know the importance of it. And even in just the last couple of weeks, Obama's come out and admitted that drones have killed innocent people. And last Friday in Syria, there was 53 people who were killed by missiles, U.S. missiles in Syria.
Right.
So what I've started to notice by the help of you and many other bright independent journalists is to look for what could be the counter narrative that's being brought to light. What I believe is going to happen, what I'm predicting, is that what Congress is trying to do is lift sequestration on the military budget for the 2016 budget. They want to have more money. There's more destabilization going on. I had interviewed Lawrence Wilkerson back in January, and he said, stay focused on Iran sanction talks. You covered that already in the show. And recently, when I was meeting with David Krieger of the Nuclear Zero Foundation, he had said, are you aware that Kerry's making a deal with Saudi Arabia, and I believe it was Turkey, in order to give them nuclear power to go ahead and do the deal with Iran? So what I'm starting to realize is that it boils down to trying to sell more weapons, have more destabilization.
It's not just more weapons. It's also more nuclear power plants.
Right. And, you know, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but one, I'm surprised by the lack of coverage in independent media on what is consistently going on. I got arrested in a foreign relations hearing where John Kerry and Martin Dempsey and Ash Carter were presenting, just talking about the innocent lives that are being lost in all of this.
Yeah.
So I wondered some of your reflections on this.
I think the situation, we have an insane mess in the Middle East. And the number one cause of it is George W. Bush invading Iraq. The number two cause of it is George W. Bush invading Afghanistan. But Iraq was very, very consequential. It was the Paris of the Middle East. It was a well-developed country. I mean, it had suffered through sanctions and whatnot for years and years. But But George W. Bush didn't just take out Saddam Hussein. He destroyed an entire state. He destroyed the state apparatus. And you know, there's just huge power vacuums all over that country, and now it's spread all over the region. George W. Bush has done so much damage. And now yesterday, I don't know if you caught this, Jeb Bush was asked, who's your foreign policy advisor on the Middle East? And he said, my brother George. It's like, really? If we were to drop a jar of jelly on the ground and have it smash into a dozen pieces, and there's like five or six of us standing around going, well, what do we do about that? And one person says, well, let's try and glue it back together. Another person says, let's get another jar and scrape out the jelly. And another person says, oh, let's just go buy another. I mean, there are so many things that need to be done in the Middle East. But I think that the main ones are supporting civil society, supporting the role of women in particular, and not military.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
As General McChrystal said to me many years ago, we can't kill our way out of this. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 28 minutes before the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Show, and rename my own program there. No, I've been calling it a program from day one. I think that's the first time the word show has ever escaped my lips. Chuck in Bartelso, Illinois. Am I saying that right, Chuck?
You said it right this time, Tom. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Great. What's up?
Well, I had a point I wanted to make with Senator Sanders. I'm sorry I couldn't get through while he was on. But why did they let that bill, the Republican budget bill, pass with 51 votes? The Republicans would filibuster everything when the Democrats were in control,
right?
Yet they sit around and let this stuff pass? You know,
well, did you hear Bernie talking about this?
Yeah, I missed part of it.
I mean, okay. Well, here's the story that he told, and at least my recollection of it was that the budget bill is not actually a budget. It's a framework for a budget. It's just a set of guidelines. It has no legal authority whatsoever. So the Democrats, now this is my speculation. Okay, I mean that's the part that Bernie shared with us. Now I'll give you my take on it. I think that Harry Reid in the Senate is picking his fights, and he's picking them very, very carefully. And he's got a big fight coming up with TPP and TPA, especially the fast track. And then that will lead to TPP, and it'll also lead to this deal that they're negotiating with Europe. And I'm of the opinion that Harry Reid and the Democrats just looked at this and said, this is just an exercise by the Republicans. It's political masturbation, for lack of a better word.
Right.
And
that was good.
And so, you know, we're not gonna waste our time trying to fight that. Let them pass it. In fact, let them go on the record as being in favor of it, so that then when the election time comes, there are twice as many Republicans trying to defend Senate seats as Democrats in 2016. When the election time comes, we can pull out this vote where they voted to throw 27,000 people off health insurance, where they voted to cut Social Security, where they voted to voucherize Medicare, where they voted to cut education all across the United States, where all this freak show stuff. They voted to cut 80 million or whatever it was out of Pell grants. You know, two of my kids have had Pell grants. I mean, it's one of the major ways that people go to college. And throw it into some political ads saying, do you really want to reelect this Republican fool who voted for this thing? I think maybe, you know, by not filibustering it, you could say Harry Reid was crazy like a fox.
Well, I hope it works for him.
Yeah, I hope so too. But that, you know, that's just my theory. I could be wrong, but I you know, it seems to make sense to me from what I know of how Congress works. Chuck, thanks a lot for the call. Walt in Kenna, West Virginia. Hey, Walt, what's up?
Well, the delightful Danielle and I have both seen the same Walmart commercial on television. It's one about how they're going to invest $1 billion in their most important asset, their people. And when the thing takes place with sort of random shots of the interior of a Walmart store,
right,
and when they mention wages, they show the number 15, which is obviously a number that is on a register position in the store. Now, I always thought that subconscious persuasion was illegal in the United States, and it's just the most hilarious thing in the world. They could take their $1 billion and divide it among their people and would probably baby buy everybody a hamburger. It's just so transparent and so ridiculous, and you realize what incredible jerks they are. But
that's very interesting. I got to tell you, Walt, I worked in the advertising business in the early 70s, and then Louise and I owned an advertising agency in Atlanta from 1997 until 1987 until 1996, and sold it, moved to Vermont. And so I have some familiarity with the industry and the business. And two things. Number one, yeah, there was an attempt back in the 60s or 70s when the Vance Packard's book, The Hidden Persuaders, came out, and he talked about subliminal advertising, and everybody was freaked out about the fact that if you went to the theater, they were flashing pictures of popcorn so fast you couldn't register them, but your unconscious mind did, and whenever they did that, people would flood the popcorn stand. And there's been a lot of controversy over the years about whether that's even real, you know, whether subliminal advertising works like that. But I can tell you, absolutely, and there were attempts to outlaw it, and in fact, it may have been outlawed for some time. It may even still be illegal to do that in television and movies. I'm not sure. But what you're describing, where they're taking a shot, a sustained shot, it's not a hundredth of a second. It's a full 5, 6, 8 seconds, something like that. You know, a full shot of you know, inside a Walmart store, and they're trying to get the aisle 15, get that 15 in there really big and prominent. I guarantee you that was not a mistake. I have been on shoots for advertisements. Every detail is taken care of. I mean, you know, is the top button on this guy's shirt buttoned? Is there a shadow over there? What is the, you know, how are the colors? What, you know, every detail, they are obsessive about this stuff, and especially somebody who's got a budget like Walmart does for advertising. So it is not a mistake, and it was not just some random thing. Whether it was an attempt to suggest or imply that they're going to be paying $15 an hour and jump on the momentum of the 15 movement, I don't know, but I would strongly suspect that that's the case, and I'm guessing that that's what you're suggesting, right, Walt?
I think you're exactly right. I wrote my master's thesis on subconscious persuasion, so I'm into this. But also, you mentioned that Danielle is a talk show host, and I wonder where we might hear her.
Are you guys still doing your show on the weekends? No. Okay. Mostly, Danielle and Shano fill in for folks. They fill in for me whenever I'm gone. They were there yesterday. They were filling in for Leslie Marshall, was it? Yep. So, you know, that's what I can tell you. Walt, thanks a lot for the call.
You're sure thing.
Thanks a lot. Lowell in Salem, Oregon. Hey, Lowell, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to first encourage you to encourage Bernie to, you know, keep up these town halls when he becomes president.
Oh, try to stop him.
We don't want him following Obama's lead and listening to corrupt economists that say free trade is a good thing.
Yeah. He won't.
So I wanted to point out, I listened to Obama's speech in front of Nike, and the CEO of Nike claimed that he was going to create jobs in America if this free trade deal passed. And
right.
That was such a ridiculous statement. You know, he claims he's paying tariffs to import goods from, you know, these other countries, but I'd like to, you know, validate that and see if that's actually true, because, you know, since we have all these free trade deals, I'm sure he's routing the Nike shoes through countries that don't have tariffs.
Well, Phil Knight's, when he was in college, at least this is the story that I've heard. I mean, I don't know Phil Knight, but what I've heard is that when he was in college, in business school, his thesis, his master's or PhD or maybe undergrad, I don't know what it was, but he wrote a thesis on how to create a shoe company, you know, or a retail company, and do no manufacturing in the United States. Basically, have the company be a marketing firm and it's all about the brand. And that's what he did, and it was brilliant. And he did it, you know, the opportunity to build Nike was created by NAFTA, GATT, the WTO, permanent normal trade relations with China, and the trade deals that we've had with these other countries, and our dropping our tariffs. There's no doubt in my mind that Nike is paying tariffs on shoes imported in the United States. We still have tariffs on over 22,000 items. You can find the list over at the Department of Commerce's website, which I think is commerce.gov. The problem is that those tariffs before the Reagan administration were over 30%. Now they average around 1.2%. So, you know, if the tariffs went back up to 30%, it would be consequential. And with regard to Nike, you know, one of the conservative arguments is, you know, you say, hey, we should go back to a tariff-based system and start manufacturing in the United States. And they'll say, oh, you want to manufacture in the United States? Labor is going to cost more. Your products are going to cost more. Well, first of all, labor is only a small part of the profit or the cost of a product. Phil Knight getting billions and billions of dollars is a much larger part of the cost of the profit. And there is some truth to the fact that we can buy incredibly cheap junk shoes in places like Walmart, you know, that came from China. And those may start to phase out if we went back to American manufacturing, and we'd end up back with shoes that you can wear for a year or two before they wear out, you know, instead of shoes that fall apart in a month and a half. But with Nike, you know, they're making their shoes overseas, but they're still selling them for over $100. It's not, I mean, if they were to start manufacturing in the United States, I'm not privy to their bookkeeping, but I would guess that they could manufacture in the United States, and the main consequence would just simply be that their stockholders would get a smaller dividend and Phil Knight would get fewer billions, that they could still be very profitable.
Exactly. That was the other point I wanted to highlight, is that each time we see the manufacturing shift overseas, the price stays the same or increases.
Yeah.
You know, the quality declines.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, Apple's got this insane profit margin on their iPhones. It was, what, 35, 40%, something like some amazing. I mean, it's just, I don't know what it is on Nike shoes, but I would guess that it's very, very high. And you know, historically, companies in the United States, when manufacturing was in the United States, worked on smaller margins, you know, and more carefully. But they did a good job, and they kept people employed, and we had an economy that worked for everybody rather than just the billionaire few. Lowell, thanks for the call. Yeah, I think that this is a pretty shameless sales pitch. I'm very distressed by it. It's 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anything Goes Friday, back with your calls right after this. Welcome back. Leonard, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in South Pasadena, California. What's on your mind, Leonard?
Well, I have a little joke. Do you know why the people in Germany during World War II had no idea what was going on?
Why?
Because they're in the Nazi party. So many people here today.
Nazi. Yeah, I got it. Okay.
Yeah, we have to really start focusing on these people are greedy, and greedy is un-American. They're self-serving, and that's all they're trying to do. They, J.P. Morgan said, hey, we're going to take it all. We don't care. Life doesn't matter either.
Right.
As we all know, as the car companies make all these death machines, that people are dying in left and right. Instead of more trains.
Yeah. And yeah. So your question is, how can people not see what's going on in this country? Here's, in fact, I was going to go off on this, but I'll do it right now. Here's why. The richest guy in Congress is Darrell Issa. He's also one of the few guys in Congress who's a criminal or who has a criminal past background. And Darrell Issa said, asked by CNN Money whether he feels personally responsible to address income inequality, he said, absolutely. But he noted that America is the richest country on earth and implied that those in poverty here are better off than the poor in other nations. And, you know, so basically this is the conservative argument, is that poor people in America still have refrigerators and stoves and televisions, and some of them even have Game Boys and things, and they certainly don't have that in Somalia. And the question that this sales pitch has been just nonstop. I mean, I remember this from the 50s and 60s, you know, conservatives saying this kind of stuff. I remember having these arguments with my dad. And really what they're saying is we should compare ourselves to Somalia. We should compare ourselves to Ethiopia. We should compare ourselves to South Sudan rather, or we should compare ourselves to Brunei, or we should be comparing ourselves to Peru, rather than, you know, places where you've got just massive, unbelievable poverty, people living in favelas and slums, you know, on the hillsides with stealing electricity and no water and open sewers. Why should we compare ourselves with those countries instead of comparing ourselves to the other 33 developed countries in the world, the OECD countries, where every single one of them has free health care for everybody? And the poor do have a refrigerator. I mean, even the poor have a basic social safety net in those countries. Why do conservatives like Daryl Issa want to compare us to the third world, basically, rather than comparing us to developed countries? And I think that's how people don't see what's going on in this country, is they're subjected to a constant barrage of right-wing propaganda that our media is perfectly happy to promulgate, because our media is controlled by the same big corporations and fat cats that are making the arguments. Am I making sense, Leonard?
Absolutely. Okay. We just have to make sure that we make rules and such that are for the masses, not just for the few.
Well, and that's the thing. It's really rare these days, since 1976, when the Supreme Court in the Buckley case ruled that billionaires can own politicians, basically, that spending money on politics is protected by the First Amendment, which had never been even considered before as a serious thought in the history of the United States. Ever since 1976, it's been increasingly difficult to find politicians who will actually talk about these issues. I mean, Bernie Sanders will talk about the average working person. You're not going to find any Republican who will do it in a way that is meaningful. It's nothing but bumper stickers and slogans. And in most cases, like with Newt Gingrich's Contract on America, where 6 of the 10 items all pointed to tax cuts for the rich, it's smoke and mirrors. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Luke Vargas with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, who point out that this Mother's Day, you can give a crystal heart to your mother. It's the mother-to-mother program through GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Luke Vargas is in you're in Moscow today, Luke?
That's correct, Tom. Good to talk to you.
Great to have you with us. So today is VE Day, isn't it? Or is it tomorrow?
Tomorrow, victory in Europe. You wouldn't be wrong for thinking it was today, given how decked out this city is in preparation.
Oh yeah, this is a huge holiday in Russia. I mean, and for good reason. They lost more people in World War II than anybody else did.
You're absolutely right. It's a statistic we've seen a lot. Vladimir Putin hosted a big delegation from the Chinese president today, Xi Jinping, where they signed, by the way, 32 trade deals. I mean, talk about doing business Sort of on the sidelines of a major event like this. They definitely got down to work, but the two were saying, we are the two countries in that whole war that really suffered the most. That's a line, you can't go here very long without hearing.
Yeah, I mean, China, the rape of Nanking, the torture of China by the Japanese during World War II, and of course the destruction of much of Russia by the Nazis. Remarkable. The UK election results. Are you knowledgeable about this, Luke?
Yes. After spending a few days in Scotland this past week, I'm pretty brushed up. And boy, just like those Israeli elections I went to cover, if I was basing my awareness of what was going to happen on the pollsters, I would have been wrong both times. I mean, everybody seemed to get this one wrong. No one saw David Cameron getting this kind of majority. Everyone thought he was going to need to cobble together some sort of coalition, and that whoever got the most votes was going to need to do that.
I have a theory about this, Luke. I'd like to reality test with you.
Oh, about pollsters.
No, my theory is that many of the voters who voted for Cameron, for the Conservatives, were not conservatives in their heart. But Cameron had said that he will put, if he's elected or reelected, he will put on the ballot for a national referendum within the next 12 months the choice to withdraw from the European Union, which means no more cheap labor coming from the fairly poor NATO country or EU countries, Poland, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, whatever. Coming into England and being able to work without a visa or without a work permit. Because a lot of people in the UK, I mean, the labor market in the UK has been really, at least many people in the UK would say, hurt by this. You think that there's anything to that?
I do. You know, the sort of line we've been hearing the most in the media is that this election was the poison chalice election, that whoever won was going to have so many problems to deal with. In fact, I think your logic is a little bit more in line with reality here, which is that many more people probably want to see an in-out European Union referendum than they may actually want the Conservative Party in the long run. I don't know if maybe I'll retract the statement many more, but you raise an interesting point that Labour was not promising an in-out vote, and Cameron was.
Right, which was a huge mistake for Labour. I mean, Labour should have said, hey, we represent Labour, and Labour in the UK is being harmed by cheap labour coming in. I mean, it would be the equivalent of doing away with the U.S.-Mexico border. You know, if we did that, can you imagine how American workers would react?
You know, it's interesting to see that Jim Messina from the Obama campaign, a top advisor, I believe, in 08, and then the campaign manager in 2012, came on board, I think it was 2.5 years ago for this campaign, around the time that Cameron made that pledge to hold the in-out referendum. One wonders if that was not identified very early on as being something you wanted to put in the minds of voters, not turn it into a campaign slogan. It's worth pointing out, talk of this referendum and talk of the European Union really at all was not a fixture in Cameron's campaign, but everybody knew that if there was a Conservative government going forward, that vote would occur. It looks like it will. Very interesting thing to think about.
I think that's good for 10 points.
It may well be. I think, you know, that's really an issue. That referendum encapsulates so many issues that were talked about.
And I'll bet because that wasn't part of the campaign, it also wasn't one of the questions that exit pollers were asking, which might account for why the polls were screwy.
That may well be. It's amazing. You know, we weren't talking about this before. We are now. Regardless, you may be onto something.
Yeah. Okay. And your other thoughts on the UK election results? What lessons can we learn? And the other thing is, it makes me crazy when the U.S. media says the Conservatives won in the UK. They're just like you know, implying that they're just like American Conservatives. When David Cameron actually supports a national health service, when David Cameron actually suggested raising taxes on rich people, you know, I mean, it's a different political system. It's a different country.
Yes, and this is not the political right of Israel. You know, we talked about the president probably not wanting.
Well, even the political right of Israel wants to maintain the Israeli National Health Service, which is one of the best in the world.
So I only mean to say, you know, I've seen many joint press conferences between our president and Mr. Cameron, and they seem to get along quite well and see eye to eye on a lot of pertinent issues. So the divide really isn't as strong as the names would suggest.
Yeah, a British conservative is an American Bob Menendez Democrat, you know, a middle-of-the-road Democrat, in my opinion.
The other thing I wanted to share with you very briefly concerns the voting system in the United Kingdom. One of the parties that actually did the best as far as the share of the vote was the UK Independence Party. This is a very anti-immigrant party, a very anti-European Union party. They only have one seat, even though they got 13% of the vote. They've been now launching on social media a campaign to push for a proportional voting system, whereby instead of going district by district, the popular vote that they received, which was about 2.5 times what the Scottish National Party received, would indicate the number of seats you get. Those 2.5 times more votes than the SNP yielded UKIP one seat, whereas the SNP's 1.45 million votes got them 56 seats. So, again, water under the bridge for the UK Independence Party, and their leader lost his own seat, so there's going to need to be some reconsideration of where this party and its message goes forward. But now talk of, you know, reforming this system is on the table. I think it could happen. You know, just a few years ago, we saw Parliament pass basically term length prescriptions, saying that now we're going to have these parliamentary elections every 5 years instead of just sort of having it at the whim of the current government. So reforms, you know, have been moving.
So you think proportional representation might be on the horizon for the UK?
It may well be, considering just how drastic these numbers were for UKIP.
Fascinating stuff. Luke Vargas with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, calling in live from Moscow. Thank you, Luke.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. You will recall in the beginning of the last hour, I went off on a rant about how Scott Walker has run his state, Wisconsin, into the ditch. He inherited a $1 billion surplus. He's now looking at a $2 billion deficit because of his tax breaks for rich people and for big corporations. And now he's looking to cut hundreds of millions of dollars out of the state university system to pay for his tax breaks for rich people and big corporations. But now Alice Ohlstein posted, just went up over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress. It gets even weirder than that. I mean, this is Republican politics at its very worst. And the fact that every American doesn't know this story is American media at its very worst as well. The Walker set up this thing called the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation back in 2011. And the goal of this thing was to take taxpayer dollars, to take money that Wisconsin citizens, voters, taxpayers had paid to the state in income taxes and other kinds of taxes, to take that money and give it to private corporations. Now, the theory was if you give money to private corporations, state money to private corporations, they will create jobs. Now, for some reason in Wisconsin, Scott Walker and his Republican buddies think that if you give money to poor people, they don't create jobs, right? They're you know, from drug testing benefits to now, you know, they want to pass this law so that, you know, they super monitor what every single person spends their food stamps or TANF or whatever it may be, you know, their benefits on. So just follow this logic for a minute. They're saying if you give money to the corporations and the rich people, they'll create jobs, but we don't want to give money to poor people. The reality of economics, and this is why Wisconsin's economy is going down the tubes. It's why Kansas's economy is going down the tubes, because Sam Brownback is peddling the same kind of Reaganism nonsense. The core essential message of basic economics, and you can read this in 1776 Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith, David Ricardo in 1817. I mean, this is not new. Or Paul Krugman today. The basis of the basic thing that drives economies is demand, is people buying things. In order for people to buy things, in order to have demand, people have to have some money. So if you want to create jobs in Wisconsin, increase your minimum wage and increase your food stamp benefits for really poor people. They will spend more money in the local stores. The local stores will then, you know, have to hire more people to help out. They will be selling more products. If those products are made in Wisconsin, then that's more manufacturing for Wisconsin. If those products are made in China, well, that gets us into a whole rant about our lousy trade policies, which I'm going to get to in just a second. But this is amazing. There was just this audit now of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation of 100 of the grants. In other words, free money given to corporations in Wisconsin by Scott Walker. They failed. The Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Walker wants to snoop on individual poor people on how they're spending their food stamps benefits. But they never audited the companies that they gave millions of dollars to. Oh, hey, it's a corporation. Hey, just take the money. By the way, our campaign could use a contribution. She goes on to write, she being Alice Holstein in the Center for American Progress's blog. The group also gave loans and tax credits to companies that did not meet its requirements and did not even attempt to fact-check claims by the companies about the number of jobs they created. Additionally, the agency forgave Rodoff or deferred more than $4 million in loan payments that the corporations were supposed to pay back to the state. Can you imagine if there was $4 million worth of food stamp fraud out there? I mean, you know, these guys, they would be on high hysteria alert. Not only that, a couple of the corporations in 2014, two corporations that received millions of taxpayer funds from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, Eaton and Plexus, what did they do with that money? They laid off hundreds of Wisconsin workers and sent the jobs to Mexico. This is astonishing. And now Walker wants another $47 million for the WEDC, in other words, to pass out to corporations in Wisconsin, while they're trying to, you know, basically screw their workers. Speaking of screwing workers, New Balance. Did you know that there is actually a tennis shoe company, an athletic shoe company in the United States that manufactures in the United States? It's New Balance. Now, you know, they used to manufacture a whole lot more than 25% of their shoes. Now but they're down to 25%, but still, they're making shoes in the United States. But Maine's congressional delegation is a little concerned about this because they make a lot of these shoes in Maine. And New Balance is looking at laying off 900 people if this trade deal goes through. I mean, this is pretty astonishing. This is from the Bangor Daily News, okay? Bangor, Maine, reposted by Callie over at the Democratic Underground. Both visits by the U.S. Trade Representative stem from free trade negotiations the Obama administration is having with 10 Pacific nations. At issue are tariffs the United States imposes on imported athletic shoes from Vietnam. New Balance depends on many 10 long-standing tariffs on certain footwear products to remain competitive. In other words, as long as there's even a small tax, even a 2, 3, 4, 5% tax on imported shoes from Vietnam, New Balance can make them in the United States and be competitive with Nike and other companies that don't make them in the United States. But here's a quote from Mr. LeBreton. This is, I believe he's a member of the congressional delegation. He says, it's literally us against every, no, it's he's with New Balance. It's literally us against every other athletic shoe manufacturer in the world. We look at it through the prism of domestic manufacturing, and everyone else is looking at it through foreign partner manufacturing. It may at some level benefit us if it went through. He's talking about the SHAFTA, the TPP. But we don't look at it that way. It would hurt our domestic operations, and that's just something we cannot stand. So why isn't President Obama in Maine at a New Balance factory that is actually employing Americans rather than in Beaverton, Oregon, suburban Portland, Oregon, at a Nike factory, a company that was built on the idea of manufacturing overseas? I can't answer that question, but I think it's a question that needs to be answered. Anyhow, anything goes Friday. Dave in Milwaukee. Hey, Dave, what's up? Dave, you are on the air.
Yeah. I'm trying to get you off the speaker.
Ah, thank you.
Okay. I believe, as do you and many, many, many other people, that we need to grow the liberal and progressive movement, and that there are too many people sitting on the sidelines who share a desire for a country that chooses progressive answers to our problems. And you say it every day when you say that democracy is not a spectator sport. We need to get people involved who think that they are not the kind of people who do those kinds of things, like protesting and rallying and standing up and speaking out.
Right.
There is only one force that has the power to beat back the conservative money that's arrayed against us, and that is people. People in numbers never seen before.
Right.
We need, and I want to work toward a nationwide rally to bring people out of their homes, maybe for the first time, to give an airing to and to promote a progressive view of America. My plan is for individual rallies in each state capital on July 16th, 2016. That's the Saturday before the Republican convention, with a goal of 100,000 people at each rally.
That's great.
Those numbers can be achieved.
I encourage you to go for it. And, you know, if you get a website together, let me know. We will promote it. It's a great idea. I think that's the kind of thing that Bernie's talking about doing, building a movement. And you can find his information at BernieSanders.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And at TomHartman.com, you can drop into our free live chat room and hang out. We'll be back. Welcome back. Let's see here. James in Spokane, Washington, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. Hey, James, what's up?
Hi, Bud, from Washington State. Tom, I heard on Bloomberg TV that Nike says the 10,000 jobs they're claiming they'll create, I guess, in USA, contingent on Congress approving Fast Track and TPP.
Right. I saw the same thing, only I thought that that Phil Knight was saying 30,000 jobs, but whatever. Yeah, I saw that soundbite.
Yeah, that's extortion, isn't it? You don't think that's criminal malfeasance?
That's you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. I mean, that's you know, longtime American politics. It's also predicated on the assumption that the American people are stupid. I don't think the American people are that stupid. I don't, you know, I think, you know, when a billionaire comes along and says, you know, give me a massive piece of legislation that's going to help me fabulously and I'll throw a few jobs your way, I think most Americans look at that and go, yeah, we've been hearing that since Reagan. And we figured out that, you know, trickle-down economics doesn't work. All it does is create a nation of peons.
One more point, Tom, about the Russians and how many people they lost during World War II.
Yeah.
I heard recently that the total number they lost was more than all the other countries combined.
May well be. I thought it was like 20 million or something. It was some mind-boggling number, although I mixed that up with the Stalin purges that followed World War II. So I'm not sure, but yeah, it's a big deal. James, thanks a lot for the call. Excellent points. Michael in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
Oh.
Hey, Michael.
Hello. Yeah, good. I had your phone hanging. So, listen, the first thing I want to say very quickly is Bernie Sanders is the most progressive, serious candidate I've seen in the 67 years of my lifetime.
I agree.
Period.
So, I agree.
So it's unbelievable. The next thing I want to correct slightly and tell you the reason for this debtor prison type things makes economic good sense. It's called slavery by another name. What happens?
Oh, I agree.
Is these guys get jailed, and they go to work at very low wages for large corporate companies, and often they make enormous profits off of them. This, in fact, was how, in a large part, how U.S. Steel grew in the United States at post-Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Douglas Blackman has a book on the subject, which he details the huge numbers of deaths that resulted from this. And I have no reason to believe that what's going on now with these guys that is providing cheap corporate labor is basically an incentive for this going on, although I have no proof.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. And there's this this incredible history. I've got to find that paper that Danielle gave me earlier. It's somewhere in my stack about how free trade actually began with the slave trade in the 1700s. You know, the whole idea of free trade was to be able to trade in slaves without paying taxes. And it's like, really? Really? You want to? Oh, there, here it is. Well, thank you, Danielle. Yeah, this. Let me just share this with you. This is by Greg Grandin. It's called How Slavery Made the Modern World. And I guess Danielle and Shano interviewed him yesterday when they were filling in for Leslie Marshall. And it's starting in the 1770s, Spain began to deregulate the slave trade, hoping to establish what merchants, not mincing any words, called a free trade in blacks. It's amazing. Free trade has its origin in slavery. Thank you, Michael. We'll be back. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Harbin here with you, and Ted at Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Ted, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure.
Keep up the good work. I think Bernie Sanders is amazing, and I have a feeling he's going to win. This may sound strange, but I hope he does.
I do, too.
But
I think he's, you know, I don't think he's, I know he's serious, and I know that when people hear his message, and that's going to be the big challenge, you know, nationwide, when people hear his message, they go, oh, really? I mean, even Republicans, really? Oh, that sounds good. So back to you, Ted.
Yeah. As you know, I'm a college librarian and professor, and I'm a journalist. I write for the Queens Gazette. I work at ASA College in Brooklyn, New York. And I recently came out with a book called The Librarian's Guide to Employment in the Information Age, because I want to give people a chance to find work using the perspective of professional researchers. In other words, how libraries actually function can make job seeking much easier if you know how to use a library.
Right.
And
so how can people find your book?
They can go to Amazon.com. They can go to iTunes. It's in ebook form, hard copy, and in audiobook form.
And the title is The Librarian's Guide to Employment in the Information Age?
That's correct.
Okay, cool.
That's correct. Like, for example, most people don't know how to use a listserv and why it's important to use a listserv.
Right.
Employers advertise for free on listservs.
Right.
So it's a great source, doesn't cost anything, and it's a way to beat the competition.
Right. Yeah, okay. Ted, I wish you the very best with the book. Thanks for calling in, and good luck. Mike in Waukegan, Illinois. Hey, Mike, you want to talk about Fukushima?
Yeah, but before I get to that point, I'd just like to say about Bernie. You know, I'm on board with just about everything Bernie says, but I just sense that he really doesn't he's not on board with the ending the drug war, or at least.
Are you kidding? Yeah. Bernie has explicitly called for ending the drug war.
Has he really?
Yeah.
Well, then I stand
at least at,
because I'm.
Yeah, I mean, the two things that I remember Bernie saying are, number one, that drug problems are medical problems and they shouldn't be criminal problems, or words to that effect. And number two, that he supports marijuana decriminalization.
Well, then I stand corrected. Okay,
yeah.
That's that. So as far as Fukushima goes, I was just thought I'd throw out this theoretical, okay, and that would be, if we were to, with the permission of the Japanese government, were to evacuate safely everyone from that site and detonate a nuclear device there just powerful enough to incinerate or vaporize the whole works, would
right.
that end the problem?
No, it would probably make it far, far worse, because the amount of nuclear material in a bomb is relatively small. You know, it's a few kilograms, you know, a few pounds, maybe a few dozen pounds at the most. And but it's enriched to 97%. It's highly concentrated. And there's literally hundreds or maybe thousands of tons of radioactive material at Fukushima. And if you were to set off a nuclear explosion there, it could cause all that nuclear material that's in the cooling pools and that has melted through the couple of the reactors and whatnot, it could cause all of it to participate in the chain reaction. I'm speculating here. I'm not a nuclear scientist, but I do know how fission works. And, you know, you get enough, you know, protons flying around and
explosion.
Yeah, it could take out half of Japan, I think. You know, it's this is the problem with nuclear power, is we have no idea how to dispose of the waste. Nobody has successfully come up with a plan for doing that, other than, you know, the France, you know, go buy a poor Pacific island and dump it on them. I mean, it's like we haven't figured out how to deal with it, and we have no idea how to deal with nuclear power plants when they go totally nuts. I mean, Chernobyl is still a crisis, even though it's covered in concrete, and Fukushima is just, you know, it's a dripping wound. It's and every nuclear power, not every, but the vast majority of nuclear power plants around the world require continuous cold water cooling, and we're talking about millions of gallons of water an hour. In many of these plants, or hundreds of thousands, probably millions per hour. And if the electricity goes off, I mean, this is one of the people who talk about climate change are sitting around going, okay, well, what happens if, you know, climate change actually disrupts civilization? I mean, if climate change gets so bad that, you know, the storms are so bad, or the you know, whatever, that you know, our electric grids go down, civilization starts to crack. The big problem is that those nuclear power plants then all turn into Fukushimas. They all start melting down.
Like if it was an EMP or something.
Yeah. Well, I don't think you. Yeah, an EMP would be another way to do it. Electromagnetic pulse, which is, you know, the concern about that from a nuclear bomb, or a neutron kind of bomb. But yeah, I mean, this is the big thing, and this is why we had to pass Price-Anderson in the United States if we wanted to have a nuclear industry. Our government is the insurer of these nuclear power plants because no insurance company in their right mind will touch them. Excuse me. At least for the whole public thing. So, Mike, thanks for the call. George in Danby, Vermont. We got a minute to the break, George. It's yours.
Well, I just wanted to thank you for having Bernie on. I have followed Bernie for 30 years when he was running for mayor of Burlington, which he won by 10 votes.
Right.
So if anybody tells you their vote doesn't count, refer them to that race.
Yeah.
But I've been very involved in Republican circles. So I'm not a progressive, I'm not a liberal, but I can tell you that in 30 years, Bernie Sanders has never lied to anybody that I know of. And of the 535 members of Congress, I don't think you'll find many of them that could actually say that.
Yeah.
If Bernie tells you the sun's coming up in the west tomorrow, don't look east.
Yeah.
And I think that him getting into this race, I really don't believe he can win it. But I think the conversation is going to change. And I like the bumper sticker, which you've taken down over your left shoulder.
Yeah, I just took it down for when Bernie was on, because I'm concerned about campaign laws and things. But, yeah, Sanders Warren. So as a Republican, you would vote for Sanders Warren?
I would have to see who was running on the – who ends up on the –
On the Republican side. Yeah, that makes sense. George, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
No, it's pretty impressive when conservative Republicans call in and endorse Bernie. Or, you know, it's just, or not endorse him, but you just say, this guy's an honest man. He really is. Anything goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Well, this is astonishing. Over at Nation of Change, the Texas state legislature voted yesterday. Let's see, when was this article? Yeah, published May 6th. So it's this week. The Texas state legislature voted to ban fracking bans. Seriously. The legislature just voted to make it illegal for the legislature or any town or any county to ban fracking. You may not ban fracking in Texas. And according to this article over at nationofchange.org, state lawmakers in cahoots with the oil and gas industry and the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, have attempted to strip municipalities like Denton of home rule authority to override the city's ban, because Denton, Texas actually banned fracking. It's amazing. And ALEC, I mean, you know, ALEC is funded by the Koch brothers, who inherited a fossil fuel fortune from daddy and now basically own the Republican Party and much of American politics. That's incredible. Just astonishing. Thanks to George for letting me know about that. Jared in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Jared, what's up?
Tom, I'd like to make a couple comments, but first a correction. Yes, Bernie won by 10 votes, but the reason he won by 10 votes is that Richard Bove, a restaurant owner, ran and got 1,000 votes. So, Bernie's terrific. I hope, I'm awfully glad he's in the race.
Mm-hmm.
But just to correct that mythology.
Meaning he didn't win by 10 votes, or he did?
No, he did not.
Oh, okay.
Because Dick Bove got 1,000 votes.
I see.
Dick Bove is a conservative Democrat, as was Paquette. And I don't know exactly why, but Dickie Bove was ticked off at Paquette, who was the former mayor.
Right.
Paquette was the mayor that Bernie defeated.
I see.
So
that's corrected. You wanted to have that's not what you called about, though, right?
No. You stole my thunder on nuclear power. you know, but what we do not need is a nuclear deal with Iran. What we need is a nuclear deal with ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no way to store nuke waste. It just, you know, just, I mean, I'm way back when I was a practicing geologist and, you know, and I've sort of followed that with interest. You know, we've tried a lot of things, but we failed at every one of them.
Yeah. And thinking in terms of geologic time, you know, million year chunks of time, there's pretty much no such thing as stable geology, is there?
No.
So, yeah.
No, there is not. I mean, plates move.
Yeah. Earthquakes happen. Volcanoes erupt. Yeah.
Well, you know, just look at Switzerland. I mean, it's just a pile of rubble. The mountains pushed up from moving plates.
Right.
The last thing, you have a book, you know, the crash of 2016.
Right.
I submit that the crucial date is not 2016, but it's 2017 and on. That's when all the ambassadors, you know, the 1,000 top people in administration, and the as you pointed out, the, you know, the 3 or 4 or 5 whatever people in the Supreme Court are going to be appointed.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I think we think this is a battle of warm bodies running for the election, but I think it's you know, more frightening than just 2016.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I don't disagree. I, you know, the whole point of the book, The Crash of 2016, is that the structural stuff has not been handled. The damage that Reaganomics has done to this country, or Reaganism, shall we say, has done to this country, has been slightly mitigated, but it has not been stopped and it has not been reversed. And as long as it continues, you know, we are on the edge of a crash. In fact, we're in a crash right now, in my opinion.
Right. So we get to reap Reaganomics.
Yeah.
The last thing is our friend Pogo. We have met the enemy, and there's us.
Right.
It just applies over and over again. You know, we really don't think past the end of our nose, which is unfortunate. Anyway, let you go, Tom.
Yeah,
always enjoy your program, and so glad that Bernie's running.
Well, thank you, Jared, and thanks for coming up with Shafta with us. Danielle reminds me, you're the guy who proposed
whatever.
That.
You spread it much better than I could have.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Well, like NAFTA, the Trans-Pacific Partnership will continue to diminish American jobs. And after the TPP, here comes the robots, 3D printers, and artificial intelligence. And the following three short headlines will illustrate what I mean. Headline, robots are rising, will cause layoffs. Purchases of industrial robots rose 27% in 2014, with China and South Korea buying 95,000 robots. Headline, China building all robot manufacturing plant. Construction has begun on the world's first factory in China manufacturing hub that uses only robots. By 2016, up to 1,500 China's industrial enterprises will begin replacing human beings with robots. And third, the world's first self-driving semi-truck hits the road. Daimler, which is owned by Mercedes-Benz, will start making self-driving robotic long-haul trucks. Tom, it's imperative that we act now to rewrite our social contract. We're at the crossroads once again. One road leads to economic devastation, the other to a better world. And I say, let the dialogue begin.
I agree. And it's time for a national guaranteed minimum income, I think, you know, it's in this context. Harvey, thank you. Excellent points. Sam in Woodstock, Illinois. Hey, Sam, what's up?
Hey. Considering that most of the Democrats, particularly the diehard progressive voters, probably have some pretty strong views on police brutality, and considering a lot of the Republicans talk about how smaller government, less over your shoulder spying on you, you know, interfering with you type of government, how come more politicians on either side of the aisle don't talk more about police brutality? It's clearly a huge problem right now.
That's a good question. I think that the police, much like the military, have historically been sacrosanct. They have been, politically a protected class, shall we say, a group of people that politicians, there's no basic upside outside of, people who are representing poor communities or in particular communities of color. There's no upside to challenging the police. And then the police have historically been very good at punishing people who do. And the mayor of Baltimore, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, is it? I think is her name. Taking on the police, asking the Justice Department to come in and do an investigation of police brutality and policing methods in Baltimore. That is massive. And she was elected on that. And she's following through on that. And the same for the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, the woman who brought the indictments against these five or six police officers in Baltimore. I think we're looking at the beginning, Sam, of a serious change in how we handle policing in the United States. But we do have a long way to go. You're absolutely right. Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, how you doing?
Great.
Maybe on speakerphone for a second here. Let me take you off.
Sure.
Yeah. I was calling in regards to the you asked a question about where are the good cops. I also wanted to ask you a geeky science question afterwards, but let's go to the police first.
Okay.
I have a lot of police officers in the family. I almost have my own precinct, so to speak. There is a brotherhood mentality with them.
Sure.
To protect their own. And the reason why they have that is because of the perception that they often fight about these bad cops. And even though the good cops know these bad cops are out there, they don't say anything because, well, when they need a backup, they want to make sure that there's someone there for them.
Right. So the guy who is covering their back might have, lifted $5,000 off a traffic stop yesterday illegally, but hey, he's got my back right now, and that's more important.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
That's I understand
what it comes down to. Now, I was wondering if I could ask you a geeky science question.
Sure.
Well, I have to admit, I only know superficially about the theory of relativity, and so let's see if we can challenge you a little bit on this. I recently saw that a movie, Interstellar. I don't know if you've seen it.
No, I have not.
Concept. Okay, this might be a spoiler alert for those who haven't seen it, but the main character, basically when he gets back to see his daughter, she's like 50 or 60 years older than he is.
Right, because he's been traveling close to the speed of light.
Correct. What I don't understand in this whole process is why is the body dictated by that spectrum? Why wouldn't the
body? Well, it's not the body; it's time itself, and also mass. I mean, my recollection of the equation is T equals 1 over the square root of m times. Oh man, it's been so long. But the time dilation theory and the mass dilation theory, I used to have both formulas memorized. Basically, mass will become infinite. Time will collapse to zero when you hit the speed of light. And that's what they're talking
about. You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And I'm guessing that the movie doesn't deal with the fact that as time slows down, mass increases, which becomes real problematic. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour, and Kathy in Etna, Wyoming, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Here's some great news to end your week with. Yesterday, I heard on Democracy Now! Amy quoting that Bank of America is cutting off financing to coal mining companies.
Mm-hmm.
That a gentleman, I didn't get his position, Andrew Pluckler, announced this at a shareholders meeting. And there's an activist group that Amy was quoting, saying, calling this a sea change. I just think that this is phenomenal news, and it should be all over the headlines. I'm stunned, but I am so happy. And I mailed to the corporate headquarters a thank you card this morning because I think that this is such a giant step in the right direction.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like it. If it's true, what was your source for this?
Amy Goodman quoted this or brought this in her headlines on yesterday's program.
Oh, that's great. Well, if Amy said it, you can take it to the bank. No pun intended.
That's what I think, too.
Yeah. Yeah, great. Kathy, thank you for the heads up on that. I'll have to dig into it. Thank you. Alex in Colorado Springs, Colorado, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Alex, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon. I have a quick point. As far as Bernie Sanders, if Elizabeth Warren is not quite ready, how about a Bernie Sanders, Alan Grayson ticket, and then perhaps in 4 years, Elizabeth Warren may be ready, and then we could have an Alan Grayson, Elizabeth Warren ticket, and we could hold the office for 12 years.
I would vote for both of them.
Oh, I say they sound wonderful. Yeah. Okay, now my second point, the reason that I called is on the deaths of World War II from China. According to CCTV, it was 35 million.
Really?
And Russia, yeah, and according to Russia TV, RT, it was 27 million. That's quite a loss.
In China.
35 million. In China. I saw that last night. I said 35 million, and I kept looking and looking, and if their state TV is releasing those numbers, you know, because Xi Jinping is over there in Russia for their big victory parade, and they sent like 700,000 troops to participate or something like that. So those are big numbers.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, World War II was, well, World War I was billed as the war to end all wars. World War II, I think the world held their breath and hoped that that was the case. The United Nations came out of World War II. You know, Woodrow Wilson tried to do the League of Nations after World War I, but the Republicans fought him tooth and nail on it. They didn't want to give up American sovereignty. Now they want to give up, you know, the right to wage war without having to answer to other countries. Now they want to give up sovereignty to the transnational corporations with the TPP, but that's a whole nother rant. But
that's a whole other problem.
Yeah.
I agree. But those are big numbers. 35 million for China and 27 million for Russia. Those are big numbers.
That's incredible. And do you remember how many what stuck in my brain is that we lost something like 400,000, 500,000 soldiers. Was it more than that? Do you know?
Well, you know what? I was watching Russia and China TV.
Yes. Yeah, so really, they weren't talking about American casualties. I mean, American casualties might have been much higher. I don't know.
I remember hearing it, but I can't remember it right now. You know, as soon as you're on the spot, you can't remember what you heard.
There you go. Yeah, same here.
But anyway, I just thought I would just throw those numbers at you, and good luck, Bernie.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Alex. Thanks for the call. And with regard to good luck, Bernie, the website is BernieSanders.com. Check it out. Did you see the story, by the way? It was over on DU today, that the guy who, this just some guy, had bought BernieSanders.com because he thought, you know, Bernie might need this someday. And apparently he paid like over $1,000 for it because it's a premium name. And Bernie contacted him and said, you know, can I have it? And he said, sure, I just want to have lunch with you. Or words to that effect, you know. So it was kind of cool. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Pardon me, I was texting my wife. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, but speaking of my wife, Louise Harmon, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to associate producers, Shane Farner and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to writers, researchers, Nate Sweet and Troy Miller, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the folks who syndicate our program, Westwood One, Pacifica, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network and Direct, all the cable providers from Comcast to Manhattan Neighborhood Network and all the others around the country, to the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Nay, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, and Jay Goodman-Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and you for supporting our program. Thank you so much. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Tom. A little bit of a rant. You know, Scott Walker and a lot of these governors are passing these right-to-work laws, and my question is, what else are they doing for their workers? Are they passing wage theft laws? Are they passing minimum wage laws? Are they passing worker benefit laws? What are they actually doing? I mean, they're obviously so concerned about the working man and woman. They're so concerned. My question is, what else are they doing? And I think the answer is nothing. Which kind of puts a hypocrisy to what their real agenda is.
Yeah, it puts the pox in hypocrisy. you're right. And this is, you know, they call it right to work. This is the mastery of right wing messaging. It's not right to work. It's right to work for less.
Yeah, kind of an aside, earlier you used the word protest. I keep hearing people use the word protest, really off topic. I keep hearing people use the word protesters. You know, the Constitution doesn't use the word protesters. It says you can petition your government. So I would argue that these people are petitioning their government for redress. So let's
You're right.
Start calling them petitioners, okay?
You're right. You're absolutely right. Except that most Americans wouldn't know what you're talking about because they would assume that they were people trying to, you know, get a petition for something on the ballot or something. But you're right. Yeah. Yeah. They are not protesters. They are petitioners. Yeah.
Well, maybe they would ask the question, what are we talking about? Hey,
it's entirely possible. It's a great idea, Bill. I will try to remember it. Thank you very much. Prez in Fort McCoy, Florida. Hey, Prez, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing? I absolutely love your show, and I am also a Bernie supporter as well. I recently got three different T-shirts of Bernie's, and they do work, just to let everybody know. I've had several people say, hey, who's Bernie Sanders? And it gives me an opportunity to tell everybody about him. But anyway, I was just I was watching Amy Goodman on Democracy Now, and she had on Ralph Nader. I guess he has a new book out called Return to Sender, and I was just wondering, it's about all these letters that he has wrote to George Bush and Obama, or President Obama, and he never got any returns from. And I was wondering if you knew anything about the book, and are letters like that usually returned, or do you know? And she also asked him what he thought about Bernie Sanders, and he had good things to say about Bernie, but he said that he also didn't return letters as well. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, what little I know about how congressional offices work, and presumably the White House is not that different, is that when letters come in or phone calls or faxes or emails, the job of the people who are at the very bottom of the food chain in those organizations, in fact, in many cases, it's interns or whatnot, their job is to try to communicate to the elected official what the sentiment of the public is. So if you write a letter to the president saying, I'm in favor of TPP or I'm opposed to TPP, or if I do, or if Ralph Nader does, it goes to the White House, somebody opens it, somebody reads it, and they open a computer, or back before computers would write it down, that, okay, we got one letter that says no TPP. And it's just like one little tick mark, right? And at the end of the week or the day or the month or whatever, they say, okay, we got 723 letters saying yes, and then we got 222 letters saying no. And we saw this with the FCC. The FCC got over 4 million letters or communications directly from American people saying maintain net neutrality. And Tom Wheeler, the chairman of the FCC, changed his position on net neutrality as a result of that. None of those people, to the best of my knowledge, because I was one of the people who sent one of those letters, none of those people got any kind of response. So the fact that you don't get a response doesn't mean that they're not reading your letter. I haven't, I'm familiar with Ralph's book in as much as I know that he just came out. Ralph is a great guy, Ralph Nader. I have so much respect for him. I voted for him in 2000. He's a good man. And we're working to get him on the program because he's doing book tour right now. He's trying to promote his book. And so I'll have a longer conversation with him about that when we talk. But I think that he's probably using this as a MacGuffin, as a kind of plot device to share his letters, which share his ideas with his readers, rather than a complaint that, you know, the White House never answers his letters. Although I don't know. I mean, we'll find out. So anyhow, Prez, thanks a lot for the call. Dan in Simpsonville, South Carolina, we got 1 minute left. It's yours.
Okay, Tom, I think that Jesus was a libertarian.
No, he wasn't. He was a liberal.
He had absolutely no use for the government. Zero.
He said when the soldier came to him with the coin, he said, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. Render unto God what is God's." He was totally fine with the government, as far as I know.
He was fine. He was fine because he said respect authority, and that's in the Bible. I know you know that.
Well, the other thing is, if you read the Dan, if you want to get into a Jesus argument, go to Matthew 25, to the part where Jesus is talking about, here's what you got to do to get into heaven, and read just the first sentence of that particular parable or story. And it starts out, it doesn't say the people or you will stand before him in the last days. It says the nations shall stand before him. I think he was very political, frankly. But who knows? I mean, who knows? Anyhow, thanks so much for being with us today. We will be back Monday. Have a great weekend. Boy, Friday got here so fast. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. You got to participate. Go to pdamerica.org. They're doing some great stuff. MoveToAmend.org, BernieSanders.com. All kinds of ways that you can participate in our democracy. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.